qualified intermediary like myself comes in, where we help administer the transaction on behalf of the exchangeor.
Yeah, I've had some people in the past go, well, my lawyer's just going to be my qualified intermediary, or my CPA is going to be my qualified intermediary. What's the problems with that if they try to do that? Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Trust This. Today is a Tactics and Tips Tuesday. I'm Joe Siegel, your real estate asset protection lawyer here in Orlando, Florida. And today I have the joy of meeting Michael Velasco, who's the founder and qualified intermediary for Exchangeable LLC. Michael has extensive expertise in standard, reverse, and improvement. We're going to explain what those are. Exchanges. Michael is one of less than 100 certified exchange specialists in the country. We're also going to explain what that is a little bit later. Michael's also founded and owned a Scottsdale, Arizona-based accounting firm, giving him deep knowledge of tax codes, depreciation, and entity structures. His diverse background includes property management, legal expert witness testimony, property rehab, flipping projects, contract for deed, and alternative financing, and significant experience with short sales and REO properties for banks such as Fannie Mae, Countrywide, Bank of America, and Chase. He holds a bachelor's degree in management from Colorado Christian University and is a proud member of the Federation of Exchange Accommodators, and he lives in Old Town Scottsdale. Michael, welcome to Trust This Tuesday.
It is great to join you, and Joe and I were just having a little bit of a sidebar before we started on all of the exchange, the issues in exchange right now, and I'm excited to kind of jump on with you guys and share my knowledge and get in the proverbial weeds on some of these 1031 exchange issues. So I'm happy to be here, Joe, and really excited.
First of all, just for the really basic, what is a 1031 exchange and what kind of property can be exchanged in a 1031 exchange?
Yeah, so a great question. Prior to the 2017 Tax and Jobs Act that was enacted, you could exchange personal property. And now we can just do real property. And I think that's the biggest, where most of the confusion comes in regards to 1031 exchange, is the trading or transfer or exchange of real property to avoid to defer taxes, long-term capital gains, depreciation, recapture on a piece of real estate. And where the confusion comes in is the term like for like. And the term like for like just means real property for real property. So you can exchange land into single family into commercial, and everything in between. We can even do oil royalties. There's some exotic DST instruments as well, which we'll get into maybe a little bit later. But the point is, you can exchange any real property for any real property as long as it's equal or greater value and an investment property. IRC 1031 gives us all the guidelines, and that's really where a qualified intermediary like myself comes in, where we help administer the transaction on behalf of the exchangeor.
Yeah, I've had some people in the past go, well, my lawyer's just going to be my qualified intermediary, or my CPA is going to be my qualified intermediary. What's the problems with that if they try to do that?
Yeah, so you got to be careful in 1031 using a disqualified party. Your real estate agent, your attorney, your CPA, not all of those are disqualified parties. So you really need a third party that's neutral to step in and help handle the funds of the transaction and help you administer and answer all your questions. So using your own attorney, it just isn't, they become disqualified and the exchange would be compromised if you used a disqualified party.
Yeah, that's one of the things we were talking about before we came on. I used to work for a title agency that we also acted as qualified intermediary, and I never felt comfortable with that because I was always scared that we were disqualified because we were also attorneys who had represented a lot of the parties in the past. And I'm like, I'd always tell my boss, I'd be like, man, I don't think we're allowed to do this. You go, keep on going. We're fine.
Yeah. So you got to be careful on that. I think there are large title companies that are large qualified intermediary companies that are owned by title companies, and they act as QIs. And there is special exemption in the code for title companies. I think where in some states, particularly back east, where you have attorney closing states, back west, we all have title companies out here. Back east, we have attorneys that help. Well, if the attorney's also representing the client in some capacity, then, you know, at that point, you know, they'd have to send it to another company to do the QI work. So, so it's definitely more on the East Coast, more something that needs to be thought through before an attorney actually acts as a qualified intermediary.
Well, and my thing is always just send people out, because it's not just that. It's also, it's complicated. I mean, you've got a forward exchange. Explain what a forward exchange is, and that, because that's really the simplest one, and it's not completely simple, is it?
Yeah, I think, and Joe and I were talking about this a little bit before we got on air. It's the nuances of this business. It's, everybody thinks it's just such a straightforward transaction, but there are so many different types of exchanges. And then within those exchanges, there's just, it's riddled with nuances. And to kind of visit with you on what a forward exchange is your most basic exchange, where you're taking a relinquished property, a property you own already, and you sell that property. The funds go to the QI, and then you have 45 days to identify a replacement property and 180 days to close it. When you find that replacement property, you'll go under contract, and then the QI will send the funds to the title company as a closing attorney and close the transaction. So that's the simplest and one that's probably most elementary, that is probably used the most common as well. And so after you sell the relinquished property, you're tasked with a tight time frame of 45 days to identify. And that's really where, in a forward exchange, people tend to like them the least, because they have such a tight time frame. So in terms of actual practicality, a lot of the clients and investors are shopping for a replacement property a lot of times before they even sell the relinquished property, you know, working on getting in under contract, perhaps with a contingency. And so I think that's your greatest constraint. And the biggest complaint we get from people exchanging their property is 45 days to identify is not a lot of time. So,
right. Yeah. And I've run into that with clients, that they just don't have time to identify. I think you can identify up to three, or it's also based on value. And yeah, they often run into that problem. It's like, well, I can't find anything. So then sometimes they end up with a reverse exchange. So explain that, how a reverse exchange works.
Yeah. And reverse exchanges, for those investors out there that have a portfolio of relinquished properties and maybe some access to liquidity, because in a reverse exchange, you're acquiring the replacement property first. And the reason why maybe more advanced investors, those with a portfolio and those to access the capital, like it so much, is they can take their time to acquire the replacement property, and they wait for the right deal to come along, and then they go under contract. And we use what they call an EAT LLC, or a parking instrument, to hold title to the replacement property. Because in a 1031 exchange, one of the rules is you can't own the replacement property and the relinquished property at the same time. So the IRS gave us revenue procedure in 2000, and that revenue procedure is 2037, where they said you can create an EAT LLC, which is a fancy term for an LLC that we're going to create that's owned by the QI, because I'm acting as the exchange accommodator and the escrow holder. And so we're going to hold title to this property in this LLC. And then at the end of the... once we acquire the replacement property, and that requires capital, right? Because, Joe, we haven't sold the relinquished property, right? So we have a capital problem, because without selling the relinquished property, we don't have the liquidity to close on the replacement property. So the other issue in a reverse is the access to liquidity. If you have the funds and you can close on it, a lot of investors choose to do that because they can close quickly on the replacement property, get a really good deal that hits the marketers, perhaps off market. We can close in the EAT LLC. Then we go to the relinquished property, our portfolio, or the property we know we're going to list, get it listed, get it sold. Once the relinquished property sells, we now have a liquidity event, right? We have capital. We can then reimburse the taxpayer for any funds they brought to acquire the replacement property. And at that point, we transfer the entity, the EAT LLC, over to the taxpayer, and we have a good exchange. And so that needs to be done within safe harbor. And we can maybe have a non-safe harbor question dialogue here in a little bit. But in safe harbor, you have 180 days to sell the relinquished property. We already know what the relinquished property is, so identification becomes less of an issue. But we have 180 days from the date we acquire the replacement property to close on the relinquished property and transfer the entity. So
you got to find a buyer for the relinquished property pretty quickly and get that.
We do. Yeah. We got to and prices, especially in this market. And we're talking here, September of 2025, we better price that relinquished property correctly.
Yeah. You know, that's Yeah. It's definitely turned into a buyer's market out there.
It has.
All across the Sun Belt. Yeah.
Across the country.
So what's an improvement exchange?
So an improvement exchange, we're going to do the same thing as we did with the reverse. We're going to use an EED LLC to hold title to the property. So let's say we've got a property in Orlando that needs, and for easy math, we've got a relinquished property worth $300,000, right? And we're going to sell for $300,000. We sell that property and we have $300,000 in the account. Let's assume it's all cash. We have $300,000 in the account. We find a tremendous deal in Orlando for $200,000. I know that's not really possible in this market, but let's say we do. And it needs $100,000 improvements. So we're going to take $200,000 of the funds from the relinquished, and we're going to close on the replacement property with $200,000. That means we've got $100,000 left in the account. We can then use those funds to improve the property. And in order to do the equal or greater value, the other rule we didn't really talk about is if we sell at 300, we have to buy at least $300,000 in real estate for full deferral. So we take the 200,000, we close on this fixer upper, we use 100,000 in your exchange account to pay contractors to improve the property to the equal or greater value of 300,000. And then at that point, we transfer the entity just like we did in a reverse exchange. But the improvements need to be done prior to you taking title to the property. And so it's called an improvement exchange. They're tremendous for adding value to, especially in the multifamily space where we're stepping in and adding value. Or if you just want a rental property that doesn't have a bunch of repairs, you're not going to get nickeled and dimed, you go and fully renovate the property. The only constriction on that, Joe, is 180 days to get it all done. And as you know, working with contractors over the years and your clients working with contractors over the years, that could be probably the most challenging thing is to make sure these contractors are on time and we get everything done at the property within 180 days.
Now, that 180 days starts running when you sell the relinquished property. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. So in a forward improvement exchange, you really need to have your replacement ready to go and close on it quickly so we could start the improvements. Yeah. Because if you close on the relinquished property and then, you know, 3 months goes by and you finally close on the replacement, well, that 180 days just got chopped in half. Now we got 90 days to get the improvements done. And that can be problematic, you know? So you want to have your replacement lined up quickly.
Yeah. And I've had people get mixed up on those time deadlines. They thought, oh, it's 45 days and then 180 days. No, everything runs concurrently. Yes. It's 45 days, everything, and everything's from the date you relinquished the property you're relinquishing to buy the replacement. That's one
45 days to identify the replacement property and all the improvements we're going to do to the replacement property. So when we identify, we're not just identifying the replacement property, but all of the repairs. And we usually take, that sounds really confusing, but we just take a bid from the contractor typically. And we've got the property address of the replacement and then kind of all the things we're going to do to it. And those have to be, you know, substantially the same as what they call it. You know, we have whatever we were identifying, we're improving, those have to be substantially the same. So you can't just throw a bid on there and do half the work. You really need to, you know, take some time to make sure that those identification of the improvements are correct.
A great tax code terms, substantially the same. Yeah, reasonable time. They love to use those kinds of terms.
They love using words like, we talk about that all the time, substantially the same. Does substantially the same mean 50% of the improvements we identified? Or right. Does it mean 80%? And so these are the interesting nuances that happen, Joe, like we were talking about a little bit earlier, is these the nuances of the business are the things that are really where you need to have an expert on your team that really knows that, either your CPA, tax attorney, or counsel like yourself. So,
well, and you know, looking at pricing, I know just the simple forward exchange is probably the most cost effective way to go for a 1031 exchange as far as what you're going to pay for a QI, and then prices go up depending on the complexity from there.
Correct. Yeah. So in my world, or if, at least for my company, you know, forward exchange is $1,195 all in for your placement, your relinquished property. To kind of give you some context, an improvement exchange started at $8,450, and so do my reverse exchanges. So they're significantly more, and you the taxpayer may be saying, why is it so much more? Well, we're holding title to the property. We've got a document suite for these, which is really extensive and expensive. And then we're usually creating an entity, an EED entity, and I'm having to file while I am in possession of this property. I also file a tax return for the time that I own the property. And so that is a revenue procedure that we have to follow. And believe it or not, Joe, which is interesting, we had a QI in California not file a tax return for the EED LLC during the time that they owned it. The state of California disputed the exchange because the QI did not correctly and it put that on their tax return. And so we had an actual California, surprisingly, caught it and and disputed the exchange because of it. So, you know, having a QI that really knows this stuff and really is thorough about what they're doing in the reporting so that it doesn't compromise your exchange.
Well, that brings me around to, you know, we talked also before we started of, you know, what is the regulation? What are the regulations out there on qualified intermediaries, licensing or bonding? Is there any nationwide standard that they all have to comply with, or how is that handled?
Yeah, that is a really interesting question, Joe, because there are in some states very limited regulation. And in Arizona, for example, very next to none on the regulation front. But a lot of the states have incorporated a bonding and E&O insurance regulation for doing exchanges, meaning you have to have $500,000 in E&O insurance and then at least $1 million fidelity bond or crime bond, which just really protects the clients. On a national level, the Federation of Exchange Accommodators is a great organization that oversees the ethics of exchanges and also has a lot of say in how we hold the funds, our exchange funds and really qualified escrow accounts, which means the taxpayer has to sign off on a movement of funds. And also they have to be in separate accounts. And then there are states that are crazy regulations like Idaho, which I happen to have a QI license in Idaho, where they really require you to get an escrow license or a title license. And it's pretty significant. Yeah, the underwriting package is about that thick. Yeah. And I went through the process because I do a lot of exchanges out of Idaho. And so I had to have a license to do that. So it's important that, And then lastly, I'll tell you, Joe, before I get into what's important, I'm a certified exchange specialist too, which is kind of like a CPA designation for an accountant. Not all accountants are CPAs, right? They have to go through a certain amount of testing and schooling in order to get the designation. Same for a CES. I have continuing education credits I got to get. And there's certain regulatory stuff that we have in regards to the CES designation. So whether you pick my company or another company, I think two things I'd look for, FEA as a member, because they oversee the ethics of, QIs and how we handle those escrow accounts. And then also CES designation just says that, you know, they're even more qualified. So those are the things I would look for. And you know, I asked some tough questions. Where's the funds held? Are they held in a separate account with under my name? You know, do I get to sign off on any movement of funds? So those are the things that I, you know, if I'm an investor, those are the things that I look for.
Yeah. It's like we were talking about too beforehand, years ago, Land America, massive $2 billion company, and they failed in the Great Recession, and all that money that they were holding, they failed because they were playing with the money they were holding in escrow as the intermediary, and the money went away one night and never came back, and all $2 billion worth of exchanges across the country just failed. And the IRS gave no leniency. They said, all your exchanges are all failed and you're going to have to pay tax, capital gains, and all your depreciation recapture, all that gets paid now because your qualified intermediary failed.
It was kind of a pivotal moment in this industry, Joe, is that how could you lose that much money for clients? And so, you know, when we hold funds, it's merely a savings money market account is where we hold the funds, and anything else that the QI is doing with the funds, to me, is a problem, you know, mm-hmm. and it should be held in something. The good thing about just having it at a national bank, we use a Raymond James bank. There's not a lot of banks. Here's the issue. There's not a lot of banks that know how to handle QI funds and subaccounts. Like, you can't go down to Chase and get them to open a bunch of subaccounts for you. So they're typically regional banks, commercial banks that really do a good job at this. But you want to have it in a bank that's been, you know, AAA rated, all that kind of stuff. That's what we do. And I think the comforting thing for taxpayers in regards to big, large national banks or banks that are big enough to where that own maybe a regional bank that, you know, we haven't lost funds in a bank in 40 some years. No clients actually lost funds. Now, if you're moving the funds offshore or you're buying mortgage-backed securities with the funds, that's a whole different issue. But an actual bank failure, it's pretty comforting in some ways to me that the government has stepped down even within the last couple of years with some of the bank failures on the West Coast there that they've stepped in and made it right for the client. So I think at least from that perspective, that's what I think about too, is that the government seemed to be, you know, if it's just a normal checking account, savings account, they seem to be backing that even more. So,
yeah, we saw that after the great crash that they still backed all the trust accounts that lawyers and title companies had because they definitely exceeded the $250,000.
They did
in a lot of cases.
They did. And we talk about FDIC and it's like, well, you know, the government's kind of, it seems they've kind of set the precedent that they're going to protect the Americans' funds as they should, in my opinion, as they should. Like, this is a huge issue that could cause run on banks and other issues that can,
right.
If we have that kind of distrust in our financial, you know, industries. Yeah.
Right. Well, I want to go back to identification because I've had some clients run into this problem that they can't identify enough properties. So one client of mine, he does this a lot. And one of the things that he does is his third choice on his identification form is always a DST. Can you explain maybe how that works or what I'm talking about when I say DST? Because I've had so many clients call me and say, I can't find anything to identify. And I go, I go, look into a DST. And they go, what's that? I said, and I always go, talk to the intermediary. They can help you with that. That's not me.
Exactly. Well, let's start with what a DST is. So it's a Delaware Statutory Trust. And this is just an acronym for kind of an investor pool that typically owns a larger commercial property. And DSTs are all in all different types of investments. It could be a land DST. It could be a commercial building. It could be a strip mall. It could be a hotel, which is an interesting play. So they have all different types of DSTs. They have some that have debt where you maybe are replacing debt on a property. They have some that are all cash. And you're mostly going to see returns between 4% and 7%. We also have energy kind of style DST where you can purchase oil royalties with it. That's actually a real property. So the DST is just a conglomerate, let's call it, of other 1031 investors purchasing larger commercial properties typically. So, and what's great about that, it gives great flexibility because there are so many of those and they're always open for identification that, like your client, Joe, that's identifying the third property as a DST, just in case the other two properties fall apart, we have a fund we can go to that we can put our funds in and not pay taxes. I would tell the clients that anytime you're going to do a property into a DST, because there are some issues with DSTs. I had a client, not a client of mine, but a client of another QI that put $2 million in a DST and never received a fund, and the fund went bankrupt. So somebody that's been doing it a long time, a group that's been doing it a long time, has a tremendous track record. At any time, real estate could, we could have another big crash. We can't control that. And that's the risk of anybody that's an investor, right? Right. It is important that you kind of vet who you're going into and what industry that you're going to be in, right? Commercial office hasn't been great since 2020, yeah. Right? Yeah. But there may be some opportunities now for getting into office because the prices are so cheap, you know? So those are the things you got to kind of think through strategically about how you're investing in some of the funds. But let's get back into the identification of the identification rules, because that's important as well. In a forward exchange, we have the opportunity to identify up to three properties, okay? And there's a couple of rules. You can change that identification anytime up to the 45th day. And so your client is identifying two properties that they might buy and a DST. Well, if you just said, hey, I want to buy three properties, we better make sure that at least one of those is going to be available for us to go under contract with. What I tell clients is identify three, try to go under contract and through inspection period on at least one of those. Okay, and then you'll have two backups. You can change those identifications at any time up to 45 days. So if two of them go under contract and you have the other one, we can drop those and we can add two more. So you can change it as many times as you want up to the 45th day. There's another rule, it's called the 200% rule. So if we are going down in value, and this is the case where we're gonna use the 200% rule. The 200% rule states that you can identify as many properties as you like up to 200% of the aggregate value of the relinquished property, meaning if I have $1 million relinquished property, I can identify as many properties as I want up to $2 million, which doesn't make sense. The 200% rule, if you're going up in value, right? Because if you identify three, going up in value, you're going to be way above 200%. But if you're going down in value, and I'll give you an example. I had somebody out of the Bay Area sell a $3 million property and identify $1,000 replacement properties. He used the 200% rule. So if you're going down in value, selling larger, buying a bunch of properties, 200% rule, you can identify as many properties as you like as long as they are under 200% of the value of the relinquished property. So those are the two rules. There's also one other rule. It's called the 95% rule, which people will rarely use that. But you can identify as many properties as you like as long as you close on 95% of them, which... There are some scenarios where that is important. I actually have one going on right now in North Carolina that we're using that rule, 95% rule. Selling $1 million, buying $6 million worth of real estate, right? We can't use the 200% rule, can't use the three property rule. So we got to use the 95% rule. So I told them during the exchange, I said, we can't cancel on any of these because it'll blow the 95% rule. So that's the danger of the 95% rule. So those are the three identification rules you can use.
Well, I hope that viewers and listeners are getting the sense that you really need to be working with somebody who has experience, knowledge, tax yep. knowledge, the background in this. You don't just go to, you know, somebody and say, here, hold my money for this exchange and trust me. Yeah. We talk about DSTs. What about tenants in common, the TSC properties? Are we are we seeing much of that anymore?
I think I have four ticks going right now. Well, the term we use is tick. In the industry, and it's just tenants in common, or you may see it as tenancy in common, and that's a vesting of a property. And you say, well, why would I use a tenants in common vesting? The revenue procedure, if you want to nerd out a little bit upon it, is a revenue procedure 2022, which basically the IRS said, yes, you can do TICs. Yes, you can do tenants in common ownership. Here are the regulations. And it gives us a bunch of regulations on how we take, how we acquire 1031 property in tenants in common. And so tenants in common is a percentage of a property. So I can own a percentage. So if Joe and I go and partner on a property and we say, hey, I'm going to be 50% and Joe's going to be 50%. We buy a $200,000 property and we both bring $100,000 to the table. Joe will own a tenants in common 50%. I'll own it 50%. right? And then we can do whatever we want with our 50% basically at any time. So if Joe, 10 years goes by, the property's now worth $400,000. Joe says, I want a 1031. And I say, I want to pay for my daughter's college, right? So Joe could take his 50%, which at that time, if it appreciated to $400,000, his 50% would be $200,000. He could take his $200,000 and buy equal or greater $200,000 replacement property with that. And I could cash mine in and pay taxes on it. If you're not in a tech, then you need to either drop into that type of formation, or if you're in a partnership, you may have to drop out of that into a tenants in common, because the taxpayer, which is important that we discussed, Joe, it's the same taxpayer rule, right? If you have an LLC partnership that's filing a 1065, that is the taxpayer. If Joe and I own the property tenants in common 50-50, we're the taxpayers, not the partnership. So the partnership, if it owns the property, has to be the buyer and seller of the property. And the solution, if we don't want to do that, is to drop into a tenants in common ownership, and then we go our separate ways. And so tenants in common are terrific, terrific instruments for owning property with multiple partners, to where it gives you flexibility to 1031 exchange. So,
one of the biggest questions I always get is, well, how long do I have to hold it as an investment to qualify for an exchange that I can then exchange the property later? Is 3 months long enough? Is a year long enough? Is 2 years long enough? How long do I have to hold it as an investment?
Good question, Joe. So if you'll ask most tax attorneys and CPAs, they'll say you should hold it for a year. The issue, like many things with the IRS, is there's nothing in the code that says you have to hold it for a year. So it leads to a lot of ambiguity. What the IRS is saying is you must hold this for investment purposes. So flippers don't qualify. Developers don't qualify. It's your intent is to hold it as an investment property. So typically they stayed a year. There is some case law that where a taxpayer sold a property prior to a year that held for the taxpayer, where their intent was to hold it as an investment and something happened. Right. There is one case where a spouse died and the wife said, I can't manage this. Right. And so she goes, I need to sell this into something that I don't need to manage. So she 1031 exchanged it into something else. Well, the IRS said, no, can't do that. And the taxpayer took him to tax court and said, wait a second. My intent was to hold this for investment property. It held for the taxpayer. So there is some case law that says if your intent was to hold it and then you just happen to sell it sooner, you get an off market offer or something like that. And there also has to be, significant gain for you to do that too, where in some cases the gain is coming from a previously 1031 property. You got all this carryover depreciation and gain from another property. That's where the issue is. Because most of the time, if we hold the property for 6 months, it's not going to go up in value unless it was, it was the spring of 2020, right? Or 2021, our properties don't go up that much in value. So all that to say, you should hold it for, your intent should be to be held for investment properties. And most CPAs and tax attorneys will tell you to hold it for a year.
Well, one of the last questions I've got for you, that I've had clients come into me and they're aging out. They don't want to exchange for more real estate. They're done with real estate. They want to start getting out of real estate. Is there any way that they can do that? Maybe the DST, or is there any other way that they can gracefully exit out of managing, dealing with the day-to-day operation of real estate and get out, that they're not having to deal with that?
Yeah. And I think DSTs are certainly an option. I think there's some triple net, commercial real estate. I had a client that did a piece of dirt for Starbucks on a triple net lease. And so Starbucks came in and built the building or another investor built it, and they just had a land lease on the thing. And it was triple net. It was easy peasy, high qualified tenant. So I would explore that with your agents, both your residential commercial agents and maybe a DST broker, is go, where can we get the highest and best return, right, with the least amount of management The only issue with DSTs is you lose control of what you're doing. The DST, you know, providers are making all the decisions on there. And of course, getting a management fee and whatnot. So you really have to think strategically and critically about, you know, where am I going to get the best, you know, the best return, probably with the least amount of what we call quiet money, right?
Right.
Is some of this is very noisy, you know, especially the single family rental game. It's very noisy. Even though you have a property manager, it seems to be very noisy. So there are some different things, and there's like oil royalties. So you can just take and go into an oil producing, you know, rights and just collect your checks, you know? So there's lots of options. I think it's just sitting down with your advisors and trying to determine what's the best for you.
One thing I have pointed out to clients over the years, it has to be United States property for United States property, because I have had people go, well, can I exchange this for property in, and it was in a European country.
Yeah, and so Mexico that or something like that.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah.
It's like, well, no, it's I mean, they want you, the IRS wants you reinvesting in America, and right. We want you buying equal or greater value. You notice that little trick too? It's like, right. Hey, we'll let you do it, but you better be going, you know, equal or greater value. And so, yeah, I think Guam, the Virgin Islands, are the other two places that you wouldn't think you could exchange, but you can. There are some limitations on that, but you can go to those two places. Other than that, it's the United States.
Right, right. Yep. Well, Michael, it's been great nerding out with you here on 1031s. Yeah. One thing before I let you go, our mission is to help people aspire to a better life. So I always ask my guests, every guest, who is someone who has helped you aspire to a better life?
Well, there are two people. One, I met a very, when I was in my late 20s, a very, an incredible man that was a hard money lender. This is back in my kind of real estate days. And he really took me under my wing, and he taught me hard money lending, which I do a little bit on the side, and really taught me all of the deed positions and the security instruments for when we were lending. And back then I was the one borrowing, you know, until I started making some money to where I could be the lender, right? Which is a much better side to be on. and he had nothing in it for him other than to just help a younger guy out. And then now I kind of teach people how to do that along with 1031 exchange. So he was a tremendous person that helped me. And then my mentor in the QI business was named Sheila Long, who is also a CES. I'm a member in the Federation with her. Another person that really took me into my wing, and I tried to pay her consulting fee. I'm like, hey, I need you to consult with you. I was never afraid to pay for the consulting, and just, hey, what do I not know, right, about this business? And she just helped me because she wanted to help me. She goes, I absolutely will not take money from you. And she helped me, and she's one of the best QIs in the country as well. And I was talking with her yesterday afternoon about a mixed use issue that we were having. So those type of people who just kind of poured into me for no other reason, just to help me. And so that was a tremendous, and of course I got to try to pay it forward and some of the people I mentor and help. So,
yep. Pay it forward. That's what we're all trying to do. I'm so happy you came on the podcast today. Thank you for coming on. I'm sure our viewers and listeners got a lot of great tips here. It's a little advanced, I hope, Yeah, and I'm glad, because I know a lot of people, I think they hear the same boring, basic 1031 talk over and over. I'm hoping that this advanced talk will definitely help a lot of people out. Michael, again, thank you. If you ever need anything from us over here in Florida, just let us know, and I'm sure
absolutely. Anybody needs any 1031 help, 1031exchangeable.com is my website. That's 1031exchangeable. If somebody like get a hold of me, lots of great videos on there. And you know, Joe's an incredible resource too. I tell you, I don't know if I've been on many podcasts, and I'm usually on one once a week, that knows this much about 1031 exchange. So I can say that about Joe. It's like, what a great resource for connecting you with the right people, you know? So it was a pleasure being on, Joe.
Well, thank you for that. We're definitely going to make sure that all your links are down in the show notes. So if anybody needs to get in touch, anybody needs a qualified intermediary, Michael's your guy. Yeah. And until then, everybody, I'm going to sign off for today and trust this.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Trust This. If you got something out of it, please press like and subscribe and give us a 5-star review to help us reach others who can benefit from this series. Until next time, keep aspiring to a better life.